Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Duke, The Life and Lies of Tommy Morrison by Carlos Acevedo, narrated by Brian P. Craig. We are so accustomed to disguise ourselves from other people that in the end we disguise ourselves from ourselves. La Rochefoucauld. Acknowledge thine iniquity. Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 13. So many blondes, so little time. Tommy Morrison. Part 1. There was pathos, yes, but there was another kind of darkness, the wayward American dream kind. On switchback roads, through knotweed fields, hard by a quick stop or a sonic, under a black or starless sky, something like that. Why not? After all, Tommy Morrison was trouble young. Hell, maybe he was born with a shiner. At first, his story was sawgrass or scrubland gothic. Stark weather, lobster boy, carpus barker, whatever. Later, it would be prize fighting, drugs, disease, prison, madness, perhaps. Morrison came from a broken home. He was a second-hand son, passed from here to there, from nowhere to nowhere bound, wherever he would stick. His father was abusive. His mother once beat a murder charge. Tim, his brother, would spend 15 years in prison for rape. And Tommy? His mother first made him use his fists when he was 5 years old against a bully at a drive-in movie theater. It was a showing of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Any biographical narrative is bound to raise questions of veracity. The life of Tommy Morrison more so, perhaps, because of how much it took place in half-light. Tough man contests, club fights in Wichita and Great Falls, orgies in rattletrap motels, stints in jail and prison, and night crawling with tweakers from crash pad to crash pad across the southeast. By nature, Morrison seemed drawn to subterranean pursuits. If there is any truth to his claim that he had been a teenaged enforcer for an organized crime ring, then you can add illicit activity, fundamentally clandestine, to his list of underbelly pastimes. Epistemological questions are also complicated by a series of X factors. Yes, Morrison was given to embellishment, lied repeatedly to his wives, and spent years in the amoral subcultures of low-level crime, boxing, prison, and drugs, which may have encouraged dissimulation. But he also suffered from the burnout effect of methamphetamine, and in the early 2000s, he was diagnosed with HIV-related encephalopathy. Combined with his career as a prize fighter, these afflictions left Morrison, already given to magical thinking, with a tenuous grip on reality. Although Morrison suffered only 3 losses in his career, he took debilitating punishment once he stepped up in class. In less than 5 years, he had been knocked down at least a dozen times in the ring, and took part in several bruising back-and-forth Donnybrooks against Joe Hipp, Carl Williams, Ross Purity, Razor Ruddock, and, to an extent, George Foreman, who rocked Morrison repeatedly with thudding jabs. What happened against Ray Mercer, Michael Bent, and Lennox Lewis, Morrison was brutally stopped by each, would have left the American Medical Association, long driven to outlaw boxing because of its deleterious physical effects, wagging its collective finger. When he was only in his mid-30s, Morrison was already exhibiting classic signs of pugilistic dementia. Slurred speech, forgetfulness, scattered thoughts, a scanty attention span, Morrison was a cognitive nightmare. He began to scrawl reminders on his hands. His interviews took on a far-out quality. He increasingly suffered from paranoia. It took roughly a year after his HIV diagnosis for him to become a conspiracy theorist. In 1999, his IQ was measured at 78, which placed Morrison on the borderline for mental disability. Anyone who had heard Morrison speak after his fights with his Oklahoma twang or read his interviews in KO Magazine and Boxing Illustrated knew that he was an eloquent young man capable of expressing himself in complex sentences. By the time he hit rock bottom, a few years after being diagnosed with HIV, a disease he would eventually deny having, that was no longer the case. ESPN interviewed Morrison in 2000, while he was serving out a term in a Texarkana lockup for a variety of drug-related charges. In his orange prison garb, Morrison looked like he had just returned from a week-long crank binge in Arkansas swampland. He was heavy-lidded, some of his teeth were missing, he spoke haltingly. Many of his answers were rote, his hair had thinned into a wispy comb-over. And as always, he seemed delusional. Name-dropping Sylvester Stallone, while sitting in a lockup no less, was more than just wishful thinking. It was the result of a mind gone irretrievably astray. When he made his deranged comeback in 2007, Morrison went beyond being a fabulist and an AIDS conspiracist. He became a con artist, one who found the perfect milieu for his hoaxes. Boxing, a barely regulated sport that thrives on deception and whose history of corruption cannot be separated from its history of champions. Because so many of his acquaintances, including family members, professional contacts, and ex-lovers, were of a similar disreputable background, it was difficult to get anyone to talk about Morrison, which is probably just as well. After all, Tommy Morrison left the world with enough lies to last a lifetime. As for his partners in denial, the ones who believe Morrison once teleported from danger in a Missouri bar, or was a victim of a vast boxing cabal to go along with a global AIDS conspiracy, they are hardly worth mentioning at all. Court records, available online to the public for a nominal fee, will tell you that Morrison had HIV and that he had been on antiretrovirals off and on for years. There is no mystery there. The real mystery is why a man would lie to himself so hard and so often that he would wind up killing himself, suicide by denial, at the age of 44. Like so much else in the world of Tommy Morrison, there is no answer to that, much less one that can be considered true. They fuck you up, your mom and dad. Philip Larkin. Tommy David Morrison was born in Gravette, Arkansas on January 2, 1969, to Tim Morrison Sr. and Diana Morrison. Known locally as the Black Walnut Capital of America because of its shelling plant, Gravette had barely 1,000 residents, but it would only be the first of many sleepy hamlets Tommy Morrison would occupy throughout a tumultuous life. Tim and Diana married in 1966, 2 years after their first child, Tim Jr., was born. Morrison Sr., originally from Illinois, was an itinerant construction worker and propane delivery driver whose rough edges could never be sanded down. Wherever there was work, Morrison would alight. Along the way, it was often whiskey and women. Then, whenever he returned home, it was often scattershot rage. When Morrison Sr. suffered an injury to his eye from an accident on the job, he developed a severe case of photophobia. As a result, he taped over the windows in the house, sat in the gloom, bottle in hand, and waited for his hair-trigger temper to catch. "It was like we were living in a cave," Tommy Morrison told ESPN the magazine. "We had to tiptoe across the carpet. Anything that went wrong was our fault. We'd leave the light on in the bathroom, we'd get the shit beat out of us." When Tim Morrison Sr. was a teenager, his brother, named Tommy, died after an accident on a construction site. Tommy had been clearing brush away so that a bulldozer could proceed when the operator accidentally dropped the blade on him. Tim Morrison Sr. held his dying brother in his arms. In a fog of grief, he wore the blood-soaked shirt from the accident for days. Then he ran off to California, and when he returned, he brought the dark side with him. Morrison Sr. often dressed entirely in black, like Johnny Cash or a misplaced existentialist, and usually added sunglasses to complete the menacing ensemble. If his sideburns were inspired by Robert Goulet, although his hero was Elvis Presley, then his worldview might have come from Hank Williams. And his cruelty troubled even his younger brother, Troy, who was driven to reveal sordid details to ESPN the magazine in 1998, when it looked like Tommy Morrison was headed for the grave. "He's a very evil man," Troy Morrison said. "He scares me. He had pornography in the house, always by his bed and in his automobiles. Tommy would be looking at it too, right in front of his mom and dad. You won't believe this, but when I was 14 and my brother Trent was 16, Tim took us to a boxing tournament and he made us stop at a strip club on the way and he brought out two strippers in tight outfits and he said they were for us. He was the devil in the flesh." And flesh was what drove Tim Morrison Sr. A womanizer without a conscience, Morrison Sr. instilled similar values in his sons, one who would eventually become a convicted rapist, the other a bigamist and the most famous athlete to contract HIV since Irvin Magic Johnson. There was nothing out of Family Circus or the Wonder Years for the Morrisons. Photographs of Tim Morrison Sr. taken in the 1970s reveal a man of rough good looks, solidly built, sometimes with his shirt sleeves rolled up just past his biceps. He seemed incapable of smiling. By then, he wore a glass eye that lent his gaze a sinister air. To his tomcatting lifestyle, Morrison added verbal and physical abuse, revealing a sadistic streak, usually fueled by liquor, that would eventually lead to tragedy. As a teenager, Troy Morrison saw firsthand the havoc of the Morrison household. Tommy's father would drink, tie one on, and beat his mother in front of him. I spent a summer there. I witnessed it. For her part, Diana Morrison, who took the brunt of the abuse, declined to elaborate on her ordeals. "I'd just as soon not go into that," she told ESPN the magazine. "But yes, I had broken bones." Both of his parents drank. He believes his mother is alcoholic and believes his father is not. Knows of no other family member other than his mother, he and his older brother, to have problems with dependency issues. He went on to explain he began drinking alcohol at the age of 12 with his parents. Valley Hope Admissions Interview, February 1999. In 2000, during an ESPN up-close interview conducted from prison, Morrison would elaborate, in tortured syntax, on his feelings about his father. "Him and I don't have the greatest relationship in the world," he said. "You know, years of seeing him abuse my mother seems like it drove a wedge between he and I's relationship as a father and son. As a business, certain things that we would do, criminal type things, you know. Until I had a son of my own, I started realizing how awful it was for him to subject his own son to do some of the things that we did." Despite their rift, Morrison inherited from his father a love of boxing and an obsession with Elvis Presley, whose likeness he had tattooed on various parts of his body, including a tooth. But he also acquired a dehumanizing view of women and a taste for alcohol. The Morrisons lived a nomadic existence, Siloam Springs, Arkansas, where the Riding Club Rodeo took place every year, Noel, Oklahoma, known as Christmas City for its colorful Yuletide postmarks, Sulphur Springs, Arkansas, home of the old Spanish treasure cave, Decatur, Arkansas, with its annual homecoming barbecue, Pawhuska, Oklahoma, distinguished by the Osage County Free Fair. But the folksy trappings of rural life could not relieve the dark days and nights of the Morrison family. In March 1973, Diana Morrison finally reached her breaking point. she accidentally killed one of her rivals. According to Dawn Gilbert, whose memoir about her relationship with Tommy Morrison came out in 2014, Morrison Sr., his mistress Donna Faye Shepherd, and Diana were all in the same watering hole in Pawhuska. Diana sat alone at the bar while Morrison Sr. and Shepherd shared a booth. There was the usual taunting from Morrison, with Shepherd chiming in for good measure. It was that extra hectoring voice, perhaps, that proved one turn of the screw too many. Angry, humiliated, and likely tipsy, Diana paid her tab and left the bar, only to return minutes later with a knife she had plucked out of her kitchen drawer. She approached the booth, flashed the blade, and lunged at Tim Morrison Sr., who jerked back at the last instant, avoiding death by mere inches. Her straying husband had been the intended target, but it was Shepherd seated next to him whom Diana fatally wounded. Shepherd died on March 4, 1973. She was 30 years old. In her brush with minor fame over the years, first as the mother of a prominent heavyweight, then as the mother of an outspoken HIV denialist and celebrity train wreck, a span that lasted nearly a quarter century, Diana Morrison rarely broached the subject of Donna Faye Shepherd. Questions from reporters about Shepherd elicited only the tersest of responses from her. It was a grim detail that served as background for several magazine profiles of Tommy Morrison, a reminder of the instability that had produced an athlete who seemed perpetually in extremis. But Diana was never anything but ashamed of what she had done, and resentful of how often Tommy Morrison would use her dark past to embellish his life story. Diana spent 6 months in jail while awaiting trial. "It was hard on the kids," she said in the ESPN documentary Tommy. "And it was hard on me because I didn't know what I was looking at. Well, I knew that if I got convicted what I was looking at, but it turned out different, and I thank God for that." Eventually, Diana was acquitted, but her marriage to Morrison Sr. could not withstand what was essentially a failed murder attempt. They divorced not long after her trial ended. "Oklahomans have always been builders. It is one of our finest qualities, and there is one other quality we Oklahomans have always shared. We are the dreamers. Everything around us all is the result of someone's dream. There can be no builders if there are not also dreamers. We are the wanderers, the gamblers, the builders, the dreamers, and the preservers. We are the cast of a human drama called Oklahoma." From an Oklahoma State tourism film, 1975. In 1980, Diana packed up her children, Tim Jr., Tonya, and Tommy, and moved to Jay, Oklahoma, a town with one traffic light and roughly 2,200 inhabitants. Although best known for producing Tommy Morrison, its only boxing champion, Jay is also the self-proclaimed Huckleberry Capital of the World, and every summer hosts the National Huckleberry Festival. It was hard scrabble living, spent mostly in trailers, and Morrison bounced around from friend to relative, the proverbial latchkey kid, except he was often away from home for days at a time. "We had kind of a screwed-up life," Diana told the New York Times in 1993, "but we all lived through it. Boxing held us together." Over the years, Morrison would paint a far darker picture of his childhood, one that seemed to presage his disorderly and sadly limited future. About his parents and their dysfunctional relationship, he rarely restrained himself. "They tried to keep you away from their arguments, but 70% of the time you'd be sitting there and he'd come in and she'd be mad and throw a coffee cup at him," and Morrison said in that same Times interview, as if in deliberate counterpoint to an understatement from his mother. "But what do? You sit there and you watch it. I had to watch that for a lot of years. I became very withdrawn. I became independent. I started doing things on my own." But boxing was a family affair. "Boxing in my family has been somewhat of a tradition," Tommy Morrison said about how he and his brother Tim Jr. got started in fisticuffs. "The last five generations on my father's side have all been fighters. My mother and father were always involved in boxing. They always wanted us to be involved in it, and we all started at a very early age." In 1976, Tim Morrison Sr. formed a ragtag amateur team that included his younger brothers Trent and Troy and his two sons, Tim Jr. and Tommy. He called it the Wolf Creek Boxing Club. "My parents owned a piece of property in Decatur, Arkansas, and the creek that ran through it was Wolf Creek," Troy Morrison recalls about the organization of the Fighting Morrisons. "I wasn't too crazy about it, but Tommy's dad lived vicariously through all of us because we all boxed, and he wanted to be the coach even though he never put on a pair of gloves in his life, but he wanted people to think he did. And you know, that was fine. We were kind of self-taught, really. I mean, honest to goodness, we were pretty dedicated. We started out at the Rogers Boxing Club in Rogers, Arkansas, and it was just a long ways to drive over there, so we started our own club there in Decatur, and he called it the Wolf Creek Boxing Club." Tommy Morrison weighed 119 pounds or so in 1981 when he was an amateur on the Arkansas-Oklahoma-Missouri circuit. His brother Tim was a few years older and had established himself first as a middleweight and then a few years later as a heavyweight. When Tim turned pro in 1987, his debut came against Oliver McCall, a future world titleist. In future interviews, Morrison would claim an amateur record of 202-20, which is as dubious as it is unverifiable. Unless Morrison was adding smokers to his tally, it seems unlikely that he had participated in so many bouts. Were most of these fights unofficial? "Back in the day, the AAU and different programs were just kind of coming on, but no, they were sanctioned boxing events," says Troy Morrison. "We fought in the Springfield Mittens, the Springfield Golden Gloves, Carthage Golden Gloves, Park City, all over the four-state area. There wasn't too many little towns we didn't fight in. Some of them were smokers, Saturday night fights, but a lot of them were tournaments, three-day tournaments." As for a ledger of over 220 contests, Troy Morrison believes that such a pace was feasible. "I would say it's very, very possible because, let's see, I boxed from 76 to 79, and I had 38 fights," he recalls. "And Tommy started in 76, and he didn't quit for years after that. I started playing basketball, baseball, stuff like that in high school. I said, to heck with boxing, this is more enjoyable. I'm getting tired of traveling every weekend to go fight somewhere, you know? But that little guy started at 65 pounds and fought his way on up. He may be counting some of the tough man contests, too, I don't know, but I would say that it might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but I wouldn't say by much." At some point, Tommy Morrison abandoned amateur boxing to concentrate on teenage pursuits. If Jay could be considered representative of a middle America wasteland, then Morrison could be typecast as one of its drifting rebels. Although Morrison was a good student and a standout athlete in high school, he had a mutinous streak that would reportedly lead to his being voted least likely to survive by his classmates in the high school yearbook. One of the most outlandish stories about Morrison concerns the night he set the high school baseball field ablaze after he was cut from the team. In a 1993 Associated Press profile, Morrison claimed he meant only to scorch an insult about the coach into the grass. Instead, he torched the entire grounds. "But about that time, a big gust of wind comes, burns down the field and the outfield fence," he said. "I think they knew who did it, but they could never prove it." In keeping with the general air of fiction and fabrication that surrounds him, the ball field incident may or may not be another instance of ballyhoo, but the fact that Morrison was a true hellraiser is undeniable. "I wasn't the model citizen," Morrison once said about his years in J. As a rowdy teen, he stole car stereos, drank beer, and scrapped wherever he could. I never started a fight, but it didn't take that much to get me interested, he said. There'd be parties, and the Indians would stand outside and wait for you. Then on the weekends, you'd have to fight their older brothers and cousins. It stopped my junior year. By that time, I'd been through pretty much everybody. Of course, Morrison had a singular edge on nearly all of his high school opposition. He had already had a fair number of amateur fights, and he was, improbably, a veteran of the barbarous tough man circuit. Tough man contests were one of the inexplicable cultural phenomena of the zany 1980s, like satanic panic, Mooney weddings, manic televangelists, hair metal. The American panorama Martin Amis referred to as the moronic inferno. In 1983, even Hollywood tried to cash in on the fad with the clamorous Dennis Quaid fantasia Tough Enough. In his review of Tough Enough for the Chicago Sun-Times, Roger Ebert summed up the allure of this repugnant pseudo-sport. The genius of tough man contests is that they combine the violence of prize fighting, the buffoonery of pro wrestling, the show business of roller derby, and the chance to see local guys making idiots out of themselves. Given all the energy expended annually in saloon brawls, it was probably only a matter of time until someone found a way to package it. That someone was Art Dorr, a Michigan-based boxing multitasker most famous for guiding super middleweight Murray Sutherland to an IBF championship in 1984. He also worked with comebacking heavyweight Ernie Shavers, who had lost a pair of unsuccessful title shots against Muhammad Ali in 1977 and Larry Holmes in 1979. Although Dorr was a prominent businessman in Bay City, he had been an amateur boxer in the 1950s, and the sport remained in his blood. He worked, variously, as a trainer, manager, and promoter. In 1979, he staged a series of local shows pitting one non-professional lout against another in a last-man-standing tournament. Dorr explained his tough man epiphany to Jeff Jacobs of the Times-Herald, Port Huron. "I've been putting on good boxing shows for a long time, and it gets frustrating to see the fans not get interested in two fine, lighter-weight amateurs. You put a couple of big heavyweights with little polish in there, and they go crazy. So I figured, what the heck, we will give the people what they want." What the people wanted was something like a large-scale roadhouse atmosphere on a Saturday night. Blood, beer, and bawdiness. The man-off-the-stool concept was an instant hit among the working stiffs in a Rust Belt state with skyrocketing unemployment. A year later, the Tough Man Finals drew crowds of more than 30,000 to the gleaming new Silver Dome in Pontiac, home of the Lions and the Pistons, triggering a barbaric fad across America. Dorr even signed a 3-year contract with NBC Sports World, the budget anthology show that also featured second-tier boxing on an almost weekly basis in the early 80s. These barely regulated melees were a grotesque parody of boxing, and that meant exaggerating its lawless mores as well. Oversight was non-existent, regulations were ignored, weight classes were dangerously broad. If Dorr produced prize fight burlesques, he was also interested in the real thing. Detroit matchmaker Lindy Lindell, who worked for Dorr in the 1980s, recalled how Dorr tried to parlay his tough man success into a legitimate boxing venture. He had Sutherland, who had just won the USBA middleweight title in the Pontiac Silver Dome in 1980, and he wanted to have, for the lack of a better term, real professional boxing, to put on shows and to have a stable of his own fighters, most notably Ernie Shavers, Lindell says. Shavers only fought once locally, practically a walkover, and other fighters came along, including heavyweight Dave Jaco from just over the state line in Ohio, and a local lightweight Billy Young, for whom he expressly had shows and for whom I made matches with Young headlining. Young won his fights in good, crowd-pleasing fashion, but by the time he beat Dana Roston in Lansing in 1989, my services were no longer needed. No sooner did the tough man concept catch on, however, than disaster struck.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?